Although the public hardly knows it, there has been a huge change in North American society. While the middle class dwindles, the super rich are taking more of the national income than ever before, while paying less taxes. Who better to explain than Professor Neil Brooks, for 35 years teaching tax law at Canada's Osgoode Hall Law School, and Linda McQuaid, the longtime business columnist, author, and social critic. You are about to hear a recording of Neil and Linda on their new book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone, published by Penguin. The event at the Vancouver Public Library, November 3, 2010, was sponsored by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. This recording is by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Our speakers are introduced by Seth Klein, CPPA, BC Branch Director.
Thank you, Shannon. And good evening, everyone. It's fabulous to see you all here. And I want to, on behalf of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, extend our thanks to the co-sponsors, the library, and Penguin Books. I also want to thank People's Co-op Books for being here and selling the books tonight, the oldest bookstore in Vancouver. So grab their brochures. And just the format tonight, Neil and Linda are going to be speaking for an hour. Combined, not each. And then we'll have half an hour for questions, and then they are going to be doing some book signings afterwards. I know it's been a distracting day, hasn't it? It's nice to be among friends. And it's such an honor to be able to introduce Linda McQuaid and Neil Brooks. I mean this honestly when I say these are two of my heroes and people who have had a huge influence on me. And I'm so happy that we can share them with you tonight. Linda, of course, has a list of book titles as long as our arm now. But when I look at them, you know, going back from the earliest Behind Closed Doors on the Tax System and The Quick and the Dead and Shooting the Hippo and The Cult of Impotence, it's you know, with each manifestation, new manifestation of the neoliberal project, she has this uncanny ability to come right out and name it and explain it, and to do it in a way that is remarkably accessible to people. Neil is, for many of us, especially us at the CCPA, he is the tax guru and has published many pieces with the CCPA. When my own understanding of tax policy was in its early formation when I was a student, it was greatly influenced by a series of articles in the 1980s in this magazine that tonight's speakers co-authored. And this was really like an aha moment for me when reading those, and something just clicked about the winners and losers from public policy choices, and I ended up drawing heavily on both of them in my own work and my MA thesis. They need little introduction. Both have published a huge volume of work. Both bring a passion for social justice to their work. Both share a unique ability to popularize economics to a wide audience and to do so with grace and insight and rare humor. I think Linda's humor is probably well known to any of us who've read her and heard her speak before. Neil is the funniest tax law professor you'll ever hear. I know that's not setting the bar particularly high, but it is. He really is. And it's such a treat to have them reunited again with us tonight. Please join me in welcoming Linda and Neil. Are you first? You're first. Neil's first.
Well, thank you very much, Seth, for that introduction. It is a pleasure to be here and to talk about our book, The Trouble with Billionaires. Great title, if I may say so. Linda's idea. And it's always a joy to be in Vancouver, and it's a pleasure, of course, to meet in the public library, one of our most valuable and often underrated public institutions. And I thank the sponsors, Penguin and the Vancouver Public Library and the BC branch of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. Indeed, the research, of course, done by the CCPA, and in particular, more generally on public policy, but in particular, those of us who are interested in social justice and a sustainable society, has really just simply become indispensable. And in particular, the great work done by Seth and his brilliant colleagues in the BC branch is particularly outstanding. So anyway, it's an absolute great pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming. First, let me say that the book is nominally co-authored, and some of you might have assumed that given our apparent comparative advantages, that Linda being an author and me a tax professor, that Linda probably held the pen and the ideas expressed might be mine. That would be wrong. It is the case at the end of the day she held the pen, but the book itself is not built on my ideas. Indeed, it's built on a vast body of knowledge that has accumulated in all of the social sciences in the areas that we looked at, including, of course, the work of the CCPA in particular. And indeed, I suppose that's one of the points made in the book, namely that society itself has a substantial claim on the high incomes that people earn, since invariably their contributions, no matter how advanced they may appear and no matter how original they may appear, indeed were simply the predictable outcomes of the vast expanding societal collective knowledge. And the added value that their individual contribution makes is invariably utterly trivial compared to the knowledge upon which they're building. That would certainly be the case with this book. However, to the extent that we do take one or two of those ideas and sort of show them from or illuminate them in some new perspective, which we do from time to time, again, you can be sure that that was Linda's contribution. She is without question one of Canada's truly outstanding and exceptional public intellectuals. She's a national treasure, and it was simply a great privilege to work on this book with her. And I might add that in terms of my own contribution to the book, it's likely to be one more futile step in what can only be described as a dismal record of non-achievement. I've actually tried to make a career out of one real simple idea, in fact, quite an old-fashioned idea, namely that rich folks and large corporations ought to pay their fair share of tax. I don't have to tell you my career hasn't been all that successful. Indeed, it's been a complete failure. Those folks continue to make out like bandits through the tax system. Up to now, maybe. Maybe this book will change things. Indeed, in my efforts to make the rich pay more, one time I was appearing before a finance committee arguing that they should raise the tax on capital gains. Capital gains, which are largely realized by high-income people, get very preferential treatment under the income tax, and I was arguing they shouldn't be getting preferential treatment, and the committee, of course, as they always did, just dismissed me out of hand. And someone came up to me afterwards and asked whether or not I felt like that knight who used to ride around Spain attacking windmills ever felt. In fact, I never felt like that, but what I did feel from time to time is like the Black Knight. I don't know how many of you remember the Black Knight. He was the character in the Monty Python movie, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And in that film, I don't know if you remember that scene, it's a classic scene. In the film King Arthur, anyway, was attempting to get across this tiny little bridge that was being guarded by the Black Knight. So the Black Knight told me he couldn't get across, so King Arthur jumped off his horse, jumped in there, and there was a sword fight. And first of all, King Arthur chopped off one of his arms. This is kind of a sick thing, but anyway, chopped off one of his arms, and the knight said, well, it's a mere scratch. And so he chopped off his other arm, and the knight's just a flesh wound, and so he kept trying to bump into him like this. No, he tried to kick him, that was it. So King Arthur cut off one of his legs, and the Black Knight just, come on, let's have that. So hopping around on his legs, so he chopped his other one off. So then he was hopping around on these stubs of legs, and so he said, okay, well, maybe we'll call it a draw. He said, let's call it a draw. And so finally, King Arthur just looked at him pathetically and sort of rode off across the bridge, and the Black Knight was shouting after him, come on back, he said, I can still bite. I'll bite your legs off. Anyway, I often feel like the Black Knight. I mean, the rich folks, they just look at you pathetically. And disdainful. They don't feel threatened at all, and they probably won't even bother buying this book, the beggars. And they, I'm sure the book won't rise to the level of a minor irritant for them. But anyway, what do you do but keep trying, I guess. Also, just incidentally, I may say, as a person who's tried to make a career, thinks the rich should pay more of their fair share of tax, it's always troubling me that I teach in a law school knowing that many of my students are going to go down to Bay Street and help the rich and large corporations even pay less tax, and to some extent be using the skills and knowledge that they learned in my class. And that used to cause me a lot of anxiety. And one day I was lamenting to my class this little disjuncture in my life, the consternation this disjuncture caused me. And someone at the back of the room got up and says, "Well, if it's any consolation to you, you're not doing a very good job of it." You know? So that made me feel a whole lot better about myself and my job in the VU University. Nevertheless, it is the case that I've tried to, my enduring interest in tax law has been the extent to which we can use the tax system to try to finance public institutions like public libraries that enormously enrich everyone's life, no matter how rich or poor you are, and the extent to which we can use the tax system to achieve a more morally acceptable distribution of income than that which results from simply market forces. So turning to the book, at the end of the book, we make these six key proposals. Basically, we say that what we should use the tax system for is in order to spread wealth around a little bit, and that we'll all be better off if we did that, and we suggest precisely how that should be done. And I won't review my proposal with you, since they're the proposals. I don't want to give away the ending of the book. But instead, what I thought I would do is just set out the seven premises of the book. And that is to say, I thought what I'd do is just kind of review the themes that animate the book. You won't find these premises set out in the book. If you're looking at it, Linda insisted we couldn't use any lists. She thinks lists are boring. So, in fact, at the end, we got six proposals, and we couldn't number them as a list. They're just kind of set out there. But let me give you a list, and these premises are elaborated throughout the book. There's seven, incidentally, and I don't know if you know why there's seven. Actually, seven turns out, like you see those books, Seven Habits of Effective People or something. The reason everything is seven is apparently seven is all the cognitive psychologists tell us. We can only remember a list of seven. We can't remember more than seven. So that's why there's seven. Who knows? There could be eight, and we forgot one. I don't know. But here's the seven premises that underlie the book. And incidentally, if you accept these premises, then you have to accept our conclusion. So what I'm going to do is just go through each one, and you can think about whether you agree or disagree with the premises. And as I set them out and you think about them, this will be kind of an interactive, you know, session. At York, they always say we're supposed to try to do more to engage students in our lectures. And so lots of my colleagues, you know, send them out in little groups to deliberate and so on. And I just tell them, listen, you listen to what I say and think about it. You know, there's a novel idea. That'll engage you. And incidentally, the agreed upon division of labor here is I would set out these seven premises, and then Linda will get up and prove them all to you. So she will give you the evidence in support of each. I hope she doesn't let me down. Also, I do have some prepared notes here, and this is they're way too long. It's a character flaw. I'm not sure what the flaw is, but I'm sure it's a fundamental character flaw I suffer from, to always sort of have too much to say. Well, partly because I'm programmed at the university for 50 minutes. But what I'll do is I'll just talk for my 30 minutes and then stop. And actually, a student came up after a lecture and told me, "Did you realize a lecture would have a beginning and a middle and an end?" I said, I talk for 50 minutes, stop. I don't know. So I talk for 30 minutes, stop. Here's the first premise of the book. If this is really what motivated the book, we feel that the increasing inequality in income over the past 30 years in Canada, in particular the increasing amount of national income that is being captured by the very, very rich, the top 1%, is the most profound change in our society in our lifetimes. And indeed, that growing gap between the ultra-rich and everyone else will continue, it is now, and will continue to reshape virtually every aspect of our society to the great detriment of ordinary Canadians. It diminishes the well-being of us all, it tears at the fabric of our society, and it corrupts our democracy. And so basically, the rise of this upper rich class is enabling them to rewrite the terms of the social contract that served Canadians and Americans so well in that post-war period in the 40s, 50s, and the 1960s, they're in effect rewriting that contract in a way that in effect means that from now on the general social institutions will largely favor their interests. So we wrote the book because we're concerned that the kind of society we're becoming, namely a plutocracy in which the rich have a vastly disproportionate influence over public policies and are in effect legislating largely in their own self-interest, and as I say, to the detriment, it seems to us, of ordinary Canadians. So that's really what motivated the book, our concern about this rising ultra-rich class. And basically our argument is that equality matters. And some people say we should only be concerned about inequality at the lower end of the income scale. We should only be concerned about bringing people up out of the poverty level. That's just wrong. A small number of very rich people are as great an obstacle to a flourishing society as a large number of poor people. And we take seriously the well-known words of the famous English social critic, Richard Taney, who said, "What thoughtful rich people call the problem of poverty, thoughtful poor people with equal justice call the problem of riches." Indeed, it's no coincidence that those countries that have the highest rates of poverty are also those countries with the highest degree of inequality at the high end of the income scale. The United States, for example, has by far the most billionaires in the world, and yet in the United States they have the highest rate of poverty of any industrialized country. Indeed, in the United States, over 20% of children live in families below the poverty line. There's just a basic immorality about that. But the point is, the fight against poverty can't be divorced from the underlying inequalities. So that's the first premise, that inequality matters, and it is, of course, an empirical sociological premise, but it seems to me it would be hard to disagree with. The second premise is that over the last 30 years, while the percentage of families below the poverty line has remained stubbornly high, the wages of workers have stagnated, the rich have been getting much, much richer at everyone else's expense. And this is the case not only in Canada and the United States, but all Anglo-American countries. And the evidence of inequality at the top end is just everywhere. Most obviously, it's evidenced by the astronomical amounts paid to athletes and entertainers, hedge fund managers, investment specialists, chief executive officers, software entrepreneurs, and top earners in the professions like law and medicine. Most of those markets have become what we call winner-take-all markets, in which small numbers of people are making huge amounts. As I mentioned, the income in Canada of the median family, that is, if you just take the family that earns the amount of income right in the middle of the income distribution of income, so 50% people make more, families make more, 50% less. If you take the median family, the income of the median family in Canada has not gone up in real terms in 30 years. Back in 1975, in 2008 dollars, the median family was making about $45,000. That's about what they're making now. It's just stagnated over that whole period of time. But in the meantime, the income of high-income people has simply skyrocketed. In terms of billionaires, for example, from 1999 to 2009, the number of billionaires in Canada has more than doubled, from 25 to 55. Back in the 1960s, CEOs made about 20 times as much as the average worker. Now they make at least 200 times. That means, of course, that the average worker would have to work 200 years just to make the same amount as a CEO makes in 1 year. If someone is only earning minimum wages, they have to work 750 years to make the amount that a CEO makes in 1 year. Indeed, on average, if you just take the 10 top-paid CEOs, they make more than 900 times the average worker, which means someone working the minimum wage would have to work 2,483 years simply to make the same amount as those folks make in 1 year. Indeed, those folks make, the salaries they're drawing, they make on about $16,000 an hour, which means if they were here tonight at the end of this little talk, they'd have earned enough to go on a first-class trip all over the world, stopping at all the major cities, whereas most of us at the end of this talk, we were lucky if we can go afford to go buy a beer and an aspirin or something. The differences are just huge, beyond imagination. And furthermore, of course, most of them are incompetent. Speaking of CEOs, I mean, and it turns out dishonest as well. I mean, I understand. I might forgive them for being incompetent. We're all a little incompetent, but it does seem to me to be pushing the envelope when you're both incompetent and dishonest. And Linda will elaborate on that. That's the beauty of going first. There has to be some advantage. But here's the real. Geez, I got to watch some. But here is the real. The studies that we relied on, incidentally, primarily, and sort of talking about this increasing inequality, and I'm just going to take a minute to explain this because this is sort of so fundamental to both what motivated our book and also our recommendations, and just our understanding of what's happening in our world, is that over the last 10 years, there's been a bunch of public finance economists in a number of different countries that have been looking, using income tax data, using statistics from income tax, and in Canada, our income tax was passed back in 1917, and so they're collecting all that statistics from people who file tax returns from 1917 on, and are making estimates about, you know, what share of the national income is going to the top 1%, of course, or the top 0.1%. And so they've been conducting this over the last 10 years, and you'll see their studies referred to a lot in the book in most of the Anglo-American countries. And what they have found is that over the course of the 20th century in Anglo-American countries, that the degree of income inequality, again, we're talking here about at the top end, can be divided into four distinct periods. First of all is, and again, it's just a central part of our claim, so let me just very briefly, at the turn of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century is what we often refer to as the Gilded Age, where there was this upper class opulence and ostentatious displays of wealth, and everyone spoke of robber barons, and everyone understood the rich were ripping everyone else off. And in Canada during that period, say in the late 1920s, the top 1% were getting around 15 or 16% of the total income. 15 or 16% of the total income being earned in Canada went to people in the top 1%. And it's important to note that those families could accumulate that vast wealth at the time because there basically wasn't a progressive tax system. And there wasn't any wealth tax that was taxing people when they transferred wealth from one generation to the next. And so they were able to accumulate these vast fortunes. And then the second period is often referred to as the period of the Great Compression. Basically started the beginning of the 1930s until the end of World War II. And during that period, the share of national income going to the top 1% dropped dramatically. It went from about 15% down to 10%, about 10%. And partly, because of financial shocks and the war and so on, but also that we introduced really progressive taxes during that period. Indeed, during World War II, the top income tax rate on people earning what would be now over $3.5 million a year was 90%, you know. Those are what people like me refer to as the good old days. We had a serious tax system for people earning lots of money. And we introduced a wealth tax. So that when rich people went to transfer their wealth from one generation to the next, the state took 50% of it. Indeed, those rates went up to 70% on wealth over a certain period. So there was this dramatic drop in it. Then, and here's the interesting part, then from 1945 right up until the end of the 1970s, the amount of national income going to the top 1% continued to decline. In the middle of World War II, at the end of World War II, it was about 10%. By the end of the 1970s, it was about 70%. Throughout that whole period, we continued to become a more equal society. And let me just make two points about that. One point is, there isn't any question, and I think all economic historians agree with this, is that continuing equality was brought about largely by government policy. Among other things, throughout that whole period, the top income tax rate in Canada was 80%. Again, it only applied to very rich people. People are earning over $1 million or so, but 80%, it varied slightly, but around 80% throughout that whole. We had a wealth tax, so that wealthy families who tried to pass all of their wealth from one generation to the next paid a wealth tax. So it was largely government policy that was explaining that increasing equality. Secondly, that during this period, As our society was becoming more equal, I'm sure as you all know, we had our highest rates of economic growth we've ever had, lowest rates of unemployment. That is, there was just broad, shared prosperity throughout that whole period. And indeed, in the 1960s, when I went to university and was growing up, the average person's standard of living was doubling every 17 years. Everyone could see they were going to be better off than their parents. And so it was a period of just sort of broad optimism, shared prosperity, and as I say, and basically our society was becoming more equal. Then what happened? I'm sure you're all familiar with this story, is beginning in the 1980s, and this is what we call now the Great Divergence. Beginning in the 1980s, the social contract that had guided Canada throughout that 30 years of shared prosperity began to unravel. And business interests, concerned that they were losing their privileged position in society, literally went on attack. And they just launched a vicious, systematic, and comprehensive attack against the welfare state. And the consequences are, of course, I mean, and began implementing what we widely refer to as the corporate agenda. Economic growth slowed, unemployment increased, but the rich began regaining their privileged position. Indeed, their share of income that they held during the Gilded Age. So by 2007, the top 1% were in effect now receiving over 14% of national income. That is, the amount of national income going to the top 1% literally doubled from 1980 to 2007. And the share going to the really rich, the top 0.01%, tripled over that period. The top 0.01% were getting about 1% of national income in 1980. They were getting almost 3% in 2007. And during that rate, income tax rates, of course, were going down. They went down from 70 to 60 to 50. And now in many provinces, somewhere between 40 and 45 is the top rate. And it kicks in at a very low income level. If you're earning $130,000 in most provinces, you're in the top income tax bracket. You pay the same marginal tax rate whether you're earning $130,000 or whether you're earning $1 million. So that our progressive tax system was just decimated. So that's the second premise, anyway, that over the past 30 years, this has been dramatic and unprecedented increase in inequality in the distribution of income and wealth. And no one disputes that. Well, except the people in the Financial Post. In fact, Linda and I got in a little exchange with a couple of the reporters from the National Post. They denied that there was increasing. But generally, no one in the reality-based community disputes those numbers. In fact, Linda wondered, what are they going to dispute next? Global warming? Anyway, so that's the second premise. I'm going to have to go. I'll go really quickly through these next ones. I'll just mention how much? 7 minutes. I'll just mention the. The third premise. No. The third premise is that. So you got to agree. The first two aren't. Equality matters, and we've had this dramatic increase in inequality at the high end. So if you're with me so far, here's the third premise. The causes of that increased inequality, some people say, well, the effect of all that income going to the rich, the top 1%, it's an inevitable result of the way the world is changing. It's just the result of technological changes. It's the result of globalization. It's the result of the increased premium that skilled workers are able to demand. But we argue that's just wrong in the book. In fact, we argue instead it's the result of a long series of deliberate policy changes in government, policies that overwhelmingly favored the very rich. And those changes, in turn, were the result of increasingly sophisticated, well-financed, well-organized efforts by the corporate and financial sectors to in effect, tilt government policies in their favor and thus favor the very wealthy. And those changes, including the deregulation of the financial industry, changes in corporate governance policies that allowed CEOs to basically set their own pay, changes in industrial relations policies that weaken labor unions, and most importantly, changes in the tax system that dramatically change the wealthy. In short, inequality has nothing to do with the dictates of the market economy. It's the result of people at the top rigging the rules to their benefit. And they got government to stack the deck in their favor and then hire people like those working for the Fraser Institutes to try to tell other people it's just the natural working of the marketplace. In the book, we explain inequality as a function of power, sustained by politics, and implemented as policy. That's our third. The fourth premise is that the wealth and income of the rich is simply undeserved. I mean, they might argue, yeah, it's true. There's all this wealth going to wealthy people, but they deserve it. We argue there's no moral theory that would justify the vast incomes they receive. Indeed, given the enormous advantages and freedoms that income and wealth provides, this skewed distribution of income presents Canada with its most pressing, or one of its most pressing, moral issues. Those opposed to the use of progressive taxes often argue, as an instrument for redistributing income, argue that there's something inherently fair and just about the market distribution of income. That is, they start with the assumption that those top income people somehow deserve their good fortune, and they usually state that position rhetorically something like, it's my income, I earned it in a free market, the government has no right to take and redistribute it to others. There's two things that invalidate that position. One is, it's just conceptually incoherent, and there's no such thing as a free market. And the second one, even if it were conceptually coherent, it does not rest on a persuasive or any theory of distributive justice. First, it's not conceptually, it's conceptually incoherent since there's simply no such thing as a free market. And the rules of property contract and property law and contract law within which individuals earn their income, in fact, are as coercive as politically motivated and have even greater distributional consequences than the tax system. We lawyers call this the baseline problem. That is, there's just a whole bunch of laws out there. All of them are a result of political decisions. And so you can't sort of say, well, we're going to look at these laws and regard this as being our baseline as to what people are entitled to. And then any laws after that are taking away something they're entitled to. They're all laws that govern our interaction with one another, property laws, contract laws, all have distributional consequences, all are politically motivated. And so that it's just incoherent to try to argue that somehow people have entitlement to income they earn before the application of the tax system. I mean, what you're entitled to is what you've got after the application of all of those laws, including the tax system. And so that the, again, there is actually a very nice section in the book on this, if I may say so, that that I think makes this point sort of clearer than I've seen it made before. And it's just a profound point. But it has to do with, for example, again, I don't mean to pick on, but I mean, think, here's a real simple example, like lawyers. We restrict admission to law schools, we give them monopoly over the practice of law, we don't allow, you know, immigrants to come in and join the law society and compete with them. We give them all this monopoly protection over the practice of law, and which means that the practice of law tends to be much more lucrative than it otherwise would be. There's no question, as a result of all those regulations, lawyers make a lot more money than they would if we just let it rip. And again, there might be good reasons for those laws. We're protecting consumers of legal services and so on, but it's odd to argue that somehow that gives them a moral entitlement to that income, and that somehow then when you impose a tax on them, you're redistributing. I mean, we redistribute it up, you know, through all these regulations. And so all we're now trying to do is achieve a distribution of income that we think is morally acceptable through the tax system. We have this wonderful example in the book from Michael Caine in England. England, you might know, raised their top income tax rate from 40 to 50, and Michael Caine said he's going to leave England if they do that. He, you know, he's got all this hard-earned income that he makes as a movie star. He's going to leave England if they try to take his hard-earned income away from him. We point out he only got that income because of government regulations. He only got that income because we got copyright laws. That means when he makes a movie, other people got to pay to view it. And so he only got it because of government regulations, and we point out that if it wasn't for the copy laws, he'd probably be making as much as any good porn movie actor would. Because in the porn business, you know, they don't enforce the copyright laws. And so some porn people, the people tell me, make a decent living, but none of them are millionaires, or, you know, none of them as much as Michael Caine makes. So he only makes that money because of government regulations. You've got a little chapter called The Porn Industry is the Only Real Free Market. And so some people say, well, yeah, but, you know, but if you didn't give them copyright protection, there wouldn't be innovation in movies and so on. I don't know about that. But people do tell me that in the porn industry, there's lots of innovation and lots of... But the whole point is just that there's a whole body of rules and protections that account for people's income, and it's odd to say, oh, yeah, but as a result of those, I have some entitlement you're taking away. And there's this... I'm not going to... We go through these... We argue also in the book that generally these people don't deserve the income they receive because most of it is just due to luck. The accident of being born into a wealthy family, the accident of being born into a wealthy country. pure accident. I mean, the one thing you've got no control over is who your parents are. And yet we know that has just a dramatic effect on how much income you will eventually earn. Just a dramatic effect. The good luck of investing in the right stock, the good luck of remaining able. So we argue that, you know, we should give you some examples. Read the book. These people, they're just, you know, they're like they flip the coin 10 times and think they're clever. I mean, like if 1,000, no, here's the point I was going to make. If 1,000 people flipped a coin, right, flipping a coin, I think 3 of them would flip 10 heads in a row. But just pure, absolutely pure luck, right? But some of these fancy billionaires who flip 10 think it's due to their intelligence or hard work. It's just pure luck, brute luck, and also much of it depends. So, okay. Second, here, the fifth premise, that now I'll go through 1 minute on each one of these. The fifth one is this. They don't deserve it. Furthermore, the amount of income that they get is, like, having that relatively small number of rich people in a society is not a benign characteristic of a society. It greatly diminishes the quality of life of everyone else in the society. And we cite all sorts of studies that show that having that small group of very rich people up there leads to a reduction in social mobility. Indeed, if you're interested in social mobility, you have to be interested. Some people say, well, let's not worry about how much the rich are getting because people can sort of move up and down the income scale and we've got lots of social mobility. In fact, the evidence is that if you've got a high degree of inequality at the top end, it reduces social mobility in the society. Indeed, the United States, which has about the highest degree of inequality among the industrialized countries, also has the lowest degree of social mobility. Indeed, if you were in the United States today and you were interested in pursuing the American dream, my advice to you would be, you know, move to Norway. You will not get it in the States. Much more social mobility in equal countries. Unequal societies have a great increase in criminal violence and other forms of social disorder, reduced physical and mental health, reduced life expectancy, just a long litany of problems that are caused by this enormous inequality. We also, of course, contribute the financial crises to the inequality. Most importantly is just that it diminishes our democracy. And in the book, we go through all the subtle processes by which wealthy individuals are able to exert undue influence on public policy decision-making. The sixth premise is that the pursuit of a more equal society is not inconsistent with high levels of economic well-being. Lots of reasons for supporting that provided in the book. A quick answer, just look around the world. You will discover those societies which are most equal, like the Nordic countries, also tend to be the most economically competitive. You will also, or look at the historical evidence. You find that in those periods of Canadian history, when we had the greatest degree of equality, we also had the fastest rates of economic growth, lowest rates of unemployment. We provide, again, in the book, lots of other evidence about that. And then finally, what we argue in the book is basically that the last premise is that if we really want to do something to reduce the inequality in our society, particularly the amount of national income going to, I mean, we have to naturally tackle it on all sorts of fronts, but you got to use the tax system. And we make an argument as to why the tax system is the most effective policy instrument. Among other things, you can target it at the top 1% very easily through progressive income taxes and a wealth taxes. It's much more, it can be effective immediately. Some people say, oh, well, let's just improve our educational system. Well, come and see me in 40 years. Maybe we can improve it. We'll make a difference. But by then it'll be too late. So we say, look, we should operate on all fronts to remove inequality, but the tax system is essential. So let me conclude. Finally, in conclusion, again, I just sort of wanted to set those out so that you, as you go through the book, you can see, you won't find the list in there, unfortunately. Well, not unfortunately, it's a good thing. Sorry, it's a good thing. It's not boring. You won't be bored by a list. But trust me, there is these very basic premises that sort of animate the whole book. So in conclusion, the argument in the book is not about bashing the rich simply because they're rich. It's about deciding in what kind of a society Canadians aspire to live in. And the social contract we think that most Canadians are in favor of is one that is premised on the assumption that each of us is born with an equal moral worth and entitlement to dignity and to the rights of citizenship. The choices individuals make as citizens, participating and voting in democracies, Democratic procedures are as important as the choices we make as consumers, that our greatest achievements as a society are the product not of individual endeavor, but of community and collective efforts, that freedom involves the power to make choices about how one lives, that most people are essentially alike, with minor differences that are often interesting, that all Canadians, rich or poor, have a shared destiny, that we're all in the same boat together, and that the quality of our lives should not be measured by the lifestyles of the rich, but by the legitimate aspirations of every individual, and that it is both just and feasible that everyone is entitled to a fair share of what we collectively produce, but only a fair share. Now, those who oppose our proposals we make in the book will likely say that lower taxes on the rich is not a matter of political choice, but an economic imperative. That's profoundly wrong. It's contradicted by theory, by empirical evidence, but most importantly, simply by our experience and our common sense. Canadians still do have a good deal of choice in deciding what kind of society that they want to live in, and choosing that society remains a political and deeply moral issue. Lately, the business interest has lamented the terrible legacy we're leaving in our children in the form of a national debt. In fact, the much worse legacy we are in danger of leaving them if we continue to allow the corporate agenda to be implemented, if we continue to diminish the progressivity of our tax system and the role of government in our lives, is a society in which resources are distributed in an obscenely unequal way, a society in which the relevant standard of living of the average family continues to stagnate, a society without a sense of itself or a sense of its collective responsibility, and a society in which the economic elite is ever more able to defend itself politically. That, the book argues, would be a truly unjust, a truly irresponsible legacy for us to leave to the next generation. Hopefully someday, because of books like this and work being done by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and other resources, Canadians will once again demand that their political parties have enough heart, have enough intelligence, and have enough courage to stand up and openly confront the power of the plutocracy. Thank you very much.
You have just heard Professor Neil Brooks speaking at the Vancouver Public Library on November 3, 2010, about his new book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. Next up, best-selling author and business columnist and co-author of The Trouble with Billionaires, Linda McQuaig.